72. I'm sorry, we're going to have to move around here a little bit. We've got people that need to go to different places. Senator Wergen has told me that this is only going to take just a few minutes. So, Senator Wergen.
Senator Murphy, I'll make this as quick as I can. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 572 concerns the school bus driver physical examination requirements. What I'm requesting is that the FAA physical be accepted for a qualification for a school bus driver license. The reason I'm asking for that to be approved in statute is that the FAA physical is far more stringent than anything that a school bus driver has to have. For instance, Mr. Wydula, who's with me, has to have an EKG yearly. There is no such requirement for a school bus driver, and it goes well beyond that even. And I'll let him explain that just a little bit, and then we'll be out of your way as quickly as we can.
Mr. Wydula, is that how you say it?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
With the FAA, there's three classes of medical. I believe I have a graph.
It's at your desk, members.
Mm-hmm.
The third class medical, which is for basic private pilot flying, is good for 24 calendar months. If you're under age 35, it's actually good for 36 calendar months, and the FAA will let you fly anywhere in the world in a private aircraft using that. Examination itself, just for third class, is far more superior and deeper than what the school bus physical is. I know with school bus physical, there's drivers that I know of that actually have handicapped parking access, and they are still legal to drive school bus. Where flying airplanes, you can't have any medical deficiency whatsoever. Second class physical, is even more stringent, which is good for 12 months of commercial flying. And then after the 12 months, it reverts to a third-class physical. And then a first-class FAA medical, which Senator Wergen mentioned, EKG is required once a year. That medical is good for airline transport flying for 6 months, then reverts to commercial, then reverts to third-class privileges. As you can tell, obviously, with aviation, with a first-class medical, pilot's able to fly, 200-300 passengers intercontinental with no problem. But currently, as you know, the state doesn't recognize that physical to drive 50 kids across town to school. So,
is there a reason why they don't do that?
When I've renewed my school bus physical or sent in the medical, I asked them about that, and they said the state does not recognize that. They recognize a regular DOT physical for driving truck.
Mm-hmm.
But not an aviation physical whatsoever. There's somewhat of a loophole there. That
is there anybody here to testify against this bill?
Senator Murphy, members of the committee, my name is Jim Conley. I'm with the Department of Public Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services. I'm not testifying against it. I'm just making you aware that the only reason we don't accept that FAA physical form right now is because there is no peripheral vision requirement on that.
Pardon?
There is no peripheral vision requirement on the FAA third-class flight physical form. So it's not apples to apples, in other words, the physicals. So that's our problem with accepting that form.
Okay.
There is a peripheral vision examination in the eye test for any class of physicals here. Let me try to find it here.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. I didn't know anyone was coming to testify.
Under CFR 14, FAR Part 67.203 for the eye examination, under Part D it says normal fields of vision. Must also not be colorblind and have 20/20 or better or 20/40 near vision.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little more stringent than current school bus standards.
Mm-hmm. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, I was just looking at my DOT certification, and I noticed it was expired, but oops. But, I've been through these DOT physicals, and it's like, are you breathing? You passed. It's pretty pretty low-key. You know, they're holding their finger out here. Oh, you see that? You know, and so it's a pretty minor physical. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that this FAA is a really stringent requirement. I am curious, though, is how many people do you think this would affect on a statewide basis?
Well, the way the airline industry is right now, I know there's quite a few people I work with that work second and third jobs. So I think it's important that it's kind of uniform throughout.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to make you aware, having firsthand experience between DOT physicals and FAA medical, I think this is a wonderful bill, and an FAA medical is definitely a lot more detailed than the DOT physical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of my experience, just for your edification, was I did tell the FAA something I probably shouldn't have, and post-haste they sent me a notice that they pulled my license for a year. So you got to be really careful of the amount of stuff you give to the FAA, too.
More than they ask.
We don't want to know what it was.
Well, okay, I will tell you, Mr. Chair, just so you don't get any ideas. It was when back in 2003, before I had my neck surgery, I was on some medications, and I did mm-hmm. make the FAA aware of that, even though it was a short-term situation. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I told them the truth, because they pulled the license for a year, so...
At least you told the truth, sir.
I'd like to add, sir, that also with the FAA medical to remain valid, as the senator kind of pointed out, any arrest or conviction of any drug or alcohol-related offense has to be reported to the FAA within 60 days, or it also invalidates your medical. And I don't believe the current DOT law applies that to school bus or regular federal DOT laws.
Right, it's my understanding, and maybe you can correct me if I'm misstating here, but it's kind of a self-reporting if you get a DWI or some other driving offense.
Yeah, Senator, if you get a DWI, you have a school bus endorsement, you will lose that endorsement mm-hmm. as soon as that hits our office mm-hmm. immediately. That's not self-reporting. That is mm-hmm. the law, and that includes all CDLs, too. First time is 1 year. Second time is 3 years, and I think the third is life on a CDL.
Okay. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, I do remember when we had the presentation from the Department of Transportation, I was concerned because it said that criminal checks were only being done on the bus drivers every 5 years, and so this is exactly what I think would bridge that gap, so I appreciate this bill.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think we're ready to vote. Senator Gimsey moves that Senate File 527 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor.
Mr. Chair.
572.
Mr. Chair, it's 572.
I'm sorry. Senate File 572. Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, that's all I was going to say is it's 572.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. On that motion, further discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thanks, sir.
Senator Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment, which is a delayed everything amendment. This is the first hearing on the bill.
Mm-hmm. All right, Senator Solon, why don't you go ahead and start explaining it, and we will adopt this amendment when everybody gets a chance to take a look at it.
Senator Murphy and members, thank you for the opportunity to present this bill before the Transportation Committee. We all know that Walter F. Mondale has spent his adult life devoted to the people of Minnesota and the people of this country. Dedicating a portion of Highway 53 in Duluth to one of Minnesota's favorite sons is fitting and proper. Walter Fritz Mondale has been involved in Minnesota's political life his entire adult life, serving as our state's chief attorney, U.S. Senator, Vice President, and Ambassador to Japan. In his role as Vice President, he traveled extensively through the nation and around the world advocating the administration's foreign policy. Fritz Mondale was the first vice president to have an office in the White House, and he was considered an activist vice president, expanding the role from that of a figurehead to a presidential advisor. Subsequent presidents have followed suit. Fritz Mondale's commitment to making this a better state and nation continued with his appointment as U.S. Ambassador to Japan by President Clinton. In his role, he helped negotiate numerous trade agreements between the United States and Japan, promoting the expansion of educational exchanges between the two nations. As ambassador, he pointed out that the United States educational system needed to respond to global pressures with this question: what do we want our kids to do? Sweep up around Japanese computers? And lastly, when we needed him the most, at a time in his life when most people would have wanted to retire, Walter Mondale stepped into the breach and replaced the late Paul Wellstone on the ballot just a few days before the 2002 election. As always, Fritz Mondale was there for Minnesota when we needed him. The words he spoke after the 2002 campaign are fitting. At the end of what will be my last campaign, I want to say to Minnesota, you always treated me well. You always listened to me. After a lifetime of service to our state, I believe it is only fitting that we show our gratitude and appreciation to Walter Fritz Mondale. As Minnesotans, let's honor Walter Mondale and his dedication to all generations of our great state. And unfortunately, I thought the mayor was going to be with me today. I've had 12 committee hearings this week, and he's been here for almost all of them, and I think somehow this got misplaced. We did contact him by cell phone. He is on his way. He is supportive of this legislation. Basically, what the bill does is that it names a stretch of highway that is part of Highway 53 between I-35 up to Highway 53. It's a brand new section on Piedmont Avenue in Duluth, which is a beautiful, beautiful highway, and received an award to be the Walter F. Mondale Memorial Drive. It also deletes a designation of Voyager Highway, which a portion of that road already had a designation of. We will not be changing addresses on the road. It will be kind of a super designation of Walter F. Mondale Memorial Drive. And we recognize that MnDOT will not be picking up the tab on putting any type of notification. The city has agreed that they would pay for that, mm-hmm. those signs.
Members, on page 2, line 13, that's what subject to section 161.139 means. That's the section of law that we entered several years back in relationship to projects like this. I believe Senator Coring had one last year, the year before, and the folks up in his neck of the woods raised the money and put up the appropriate markings that we allowed them to do. This sounds along the same vein, and I believe that it's a worthy project. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The appropriate moment, I'd like to make the motion. I'm proud that Walter Mondale lives in my district. Also, I'd like to make the request of Senator Solon to be added as a co-author to the bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I'd be glad to add your name as a co-author.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Contrary to my my former colleague who had a great thing about naming highways, Senator Oliver, you may remember, I don't hold the same view, so I'm not opposing your bill, but I have a teensy little technical thing that looks like punctuation that I'm trying to understand in your delete all amendment. On page 121, after Duluth, it looks like you're deleting the top half of a semicolon and adding a period, which I don't understand, and then beginning what appears to be a new sentence, but they're not sentences. So what is the could that not be? I don't know. I don't know what's accurate, but that doesn't seem to make any sense. Or is that dash taking out the whole semicolon and putting a period there?
Senator Olson, Ms. Berezovsky says yes, that dash takes out the whole semicolon and then it's a new sentence.
So it's a new sentence. And is that because there's an interruption in that we're taking a segment in between that is labeled that, and so you're starting with a new sentence? All right, thank you.
Okay. Further discussion.
Mr. Chair, the mayor.
Oh, Mr. Mayor.
Able to join us.
Please.
If I could, I'd just like to add that the city is prepared to accept the cost of creating the signs for the new drive. We'd be very proud to be home to Walter Mondale Drive. It would be our privilege to have a road in our community named for such a great man.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Any further discussion from the committee? Senator Dibble has moved.
Yes.
As amended.
First, we need to adopt the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Dibble has moved Senate File 108 as amended to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. Further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Thank you,
Senator Sola, Mr. Mayor.
Members.
Thank you.
Next, I believe we're going to have a discussion about the impact of property taxes as it relates to transportation funding. And we have Mr. Ouellette is here and Mr. Gagneau. If you gentlemen would want to come to the table. We'll start off with Mr. Ouellette and then go to Mr. Gagneau, and then just so we know the right order, then we'll have Mayor Kleiss, Mr. Grindley, Mr. Sheehan, and then Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a handout. My name is Eric Ouellette. I'm the Policy Analysis Manager for the League of Minnesota Cities, and I was asked to put together, I'm sort of the data guy for the League of Cities, and I was asked to do the best I could to put together information that would illustrate across the state what the connection is between a property tax increases and local road spending, and the handout that's being passed out is my best effort at doing that. There is a bit of a challenge in making a one-to-one connection because, as with the state budget, a lot of different types of revenues go into city and county and township general funds, and a lot of road funding comes out of the general fund. So drawing a direct connection between one revenue source and one type of spending is a little bit difficult to do. Some of the analysts at the House Research Department across the street did some work on trying to frame the issue as best they could, and that information is in the table on the upper right-hand corner of the handout. And basically what it shows is when you take away when you look at total spending on roads by cities, counties, and townships, and you take away the revenues that come from the federal government or state government that are dedicated for transportation, what you have left is that first column, which is own source spending on roads. It's an estimate of how much cities, counties, and towns spend on roads annually since 1988. From all local sources that come out of the general fund, which would include some general purpose state aids, but those are dollars that go into the general fund. And then the second column shows our property tax levies. This is, again, cities, towns, and counties. And the relationship between the two since 1988, you'll see it's been roughly about equal to a third of the amount of dollars that local governments have been levying is the amount they've been spending on roads for local from local sources. Now, again, that own source spending includes other revenue sources like special assessments and general aids and other miscellaneous revenues. But the relationship has been very steady over time, which I think indicates that as property taxes have grown, the money we've spent on transportation has been a full contributor of its fair share to property tax increases. It hasn't been the only source of pressure, but we can say with confidence that it has been a full contributor to the problem. And I think these numbers could fairly be characterized as very conservative. When the House research staff put these numbers together and there was any question as to how they should calculate the numbers, they took the more conservative route to understate the local impact as much as possible. So I think this is the low ball estimate on the property tax impact in this table here, and I can share, if anyone has interest in it, I have a memo from Pat Dalton on the details of how the aids were calculated. Now, the city officials who are going to follow me will be able to say with a lot more certainty what the connection is between property taxes and road funding, because on an individual city's budget, they have a lot more information on the direct connection between revenues and expenditures. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the chart on the bottom, because I do represent cities, and I do have a little bit more information about city government. On the chart on the bottom, I took just the city portion of the numbers from the table above, and I was able to divide the own source revenue piece into special assessments and other revenues, because I do have data on special assessments. And I think what that chart shows is, if you look at the top part of the bars, which is the white part, that is non-special assessment local revenues, which would predominantly be property taxes and other general revenues like LGA. And clearly there's been a significant increase in city reliance on those non-special assessment revenues to pay for roads at the local level. And when you couple that with what we know has been significant reductions in state aid over time, it's easy to see the connection that, at least in the last few years, the pressure on property taxes has been particularly acute. Again, this is very broad background information on what's going on across the state. Each jurisdiction is going to have different experiences, and you'll hear about some of them from the speakers that follow. But I think this sets the table for the discussion and sets a sort of a framework.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ouellette. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ouellette, I'm looking at the graph that you have on the top right-hand corner, and I have to tell you that the property tax division is extremely concerned about what's going on with regard to property tax increases. As I look at this graph, I think that what is most notable to me is from 1989 to 2001, which is 12 years, was $140 million of increase. And from 2001 to 2004, which is 3 or 4 years, it's another $147 million of road levies. So what the concern is not the percentage of the levies, it's the increase in the levies. And what the property tax division has been focusing in on is that as the state commitment to their partnership has reduced, the local units have had only one option, and that's to turn to the levy. And this is, as the CASA funding, I would speculate, has not fulfilled the needs, they've turned to the levy, and that's resulting in this, more than double-digit increase in the last 4 years. And so if you or the testifiers that are coming up would like to address some of that aspect, I would be appreciative.
Mr. Chair Willett. And Senator Scoy, you made the point much more eloquently than I could. Property taxes have been increasing significantly, and the chart shows that. And I think the table shows how much transportation spending has been a full contributor to those large increases. So I think that's correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, in the own source column, 510 what?
Oh, I'm sorry, $1 million.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Ouellette, am I seeing this?
12 years to get there, and then we do it the same thing in the next 4 years.
It's doubled since 1988.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Inflation has run local, state and local government implicit price deflator has been about 60% in that time. Population has increased about 25% in that time. So the increases have exceeded those two factors. But it's big increases.
That's staggering. Well, let's hear from Mr. Any further questions for Mr. Ouellette? Mr. Gagneau, welcome to the committee, and thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was asked to put a face on one city's struggle with road funding, and there's a chart that was passed out ahead of time. It's this black and white one that looks like this, which illustrates just for the city of Minnetonka our situation in road funding. Those are also in millions. I'm sorry, Senator Olson, I didn't label that. A decade ago, we were spending roughly $3 million a year on our roads, about half of that from our share of the MSA funding and half of that from local property taxes. Unfortunately, what's happened with our MSA funding has basically been the same for the last 10 years, the same dollar amount. The pot has gotten bigger, but as more cities qualify for that, then our share of that pot has been reduced. So essentially, we've gotten about the same dollar amount for the last decade. Obviously, asphalt costs more than it did 10 years ago, and so we've been filling in the difference with property taxes.
Mr. Gagneau, can I ask, do you know what the population change was in your city from 94 to just say 2006?
Not dramatic. We've been growing in that period less than 1% a year. So we've been fairly developed. And that's a good point, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Gridley from Woodbury can speak to the challenges of a growing community where we're really talking about just maintaining and reconstruction of our roads.
Okay, thanks.
Much more dramatic in a growing community. What we did was fill in the difference, as I mentioned, and then a couple of years ago decided that we were losing too much ground. Literally, we were falling too far behind in our road index. We try to maintain an index of about an 80 rating, where 100 is a brand new road, the average rating then in the city of about an 80. 70 is considered the lowest acceptable, judging by the phone calls as well as just the our community surveys. In order to maintain that level, we started ramping up our investments. In fact, last year and this year, two major increases in our property tax levy. In fact, both over the year 2005 and 6, it notes on here, two-thirds of that increase has been strictly for road improvements. We think this is not buying us a Cadillac system. We think this will keep us between 70 and 80 rating over the next 10 years. We're hopeful that the state will adopt a long-term transportation funding plan, hopefully this year, in order to take some of the pressure off of property taxes. We do feel that a user fee is the right way to go for roads, and the message I'd like to leave with the committee is that 80% of our roads in Minnetonka are local streets, and there's a great deal of discussion about state transportation needs, but the local city, county, township transportation needs are similar. We're often asked, I'm here representing the MLC, suburban communities, and we're often asked what forms of transportation funding do we support, and our answer is anything. We're to the point where we think whatever package you put together, we'd encourage you to develop a long-term sustainable transportation plan to try to take some of the pressure off of our local property taxes.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just reminded of the presentation we received in committee now a couple years ago, so of course some here didn't benefit from that, but David Sonnenberg came. He had been the Public Works Director for the City of Minneapolis, and Mr. Gagneau reminded me of that because he talked about the, you know, maintaining the up to a certain level of road standard, and there's a tipping point beyond which roads, if you're not maintaining them, then you're a whole lot of money behind because, of course, it's very intuitive. If the road surface cracks and there's a lot of infiltration of moisture down into the road bed, the deterioration becomes much more dramatic, much more quickly, and then you're looking at not just maintenance but wholesale reconstruction, digging out, replacing the road bed with the contractor grade fill or concrete, and then we're that much more money behind. So letting and cities, municipalities, locals are largely responsible for maintaining a great deal of our road network, so we're wise to allow them to do that job to the best of their ability.
And a classic example of that is just leave here and drive up Summit Avenue. You'll see exactly what Senator Dibble's talking about. Mr. Gagneau.
Oh, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, Mr. Sonnenberg was the Public Works Director in Minnetonka before he went to Minneapolis.
Oh, yeah.
That 70 rating is kind of that tipping point that we always tried to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
I should say we have taken, as many cities, interim steps. In fact, Minnetonka has used something we called a thin overlay program that we kind of piloted a few years ago, and now we've ramped up in an effort to maintain the roads longer rather than just the seal coating. And what it is, it's not the milling overlay, but just an overlay, and we've determined that it extends the life of our roads 5 to 8 years, but it's just temporary. It can only maintain it for that long, and then we do have to do the reconstruction that was talked about.
Right. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Gagneau is my personal city manager, so I just have to say what a great job he does at the city, and we are very fortunate to have him, and I can attest to the great property tax increase in the last year due to this, because I felt it. Thank you.
Senator Olson and Senator Dole.
Okay.
Olson, I'm sorry.
I was looking over there.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gagneau, with a thin overlay, are you guys putting down like a Petromat or a surface between the layers of blacktop? And then also, what is your estimated cost per mile on that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I'm sorry, I don't have an estimated cost per mile. It's a fraction of the price of the mill and overlay. But it is it's basically the overlay without the mill. And so we patch the underlying surface defects and then put a smooth coat over the top of that. And we've had quite a bit of interest from other cities because of that. The seal coat doesn't really extend the life of the road, even though it smooths it out and makes it look better. And we've determined that this does buy us some more time, but obviously not enough for a major reconstruction eventually.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick follow-up, if I may. And, yeah, you're saying it's temporary. Do you have any idea of what your life expectancy, 5 years, or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, 5 to 8 years is our estimate for what the extension of the extra time we get by doing that from the current conditions.
Mm-hmm. Like a 3-inch lift, or?
Actually, it's less than an inch. Average is about 3/4. They said you're a city manager if you know more about sewage and road projects than anything else. But it's about less than an inch.
Mm-hmm. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gagneau and Mr. Ouellette, Mr. Gagneau, you said that the funding that you've got, 2/3 of that goes to road improvements, so the rest of it's for new construction of roads. Is that also true for just in general for the rest of the counties? Is these initial numbers that we looked at from 88 through 2004, that kind of breakdown?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, I'm sorry. I meant 2/3 of the total increase. Our average increase over the last 10 years for general city operations, police, fire, everything else, is in the sort of 3-4% range, inflation growth, that kind of range. The increase on top of that was dedicated to roads, so the 2/3. Our property taxes for the last 2 years have gone up between 9% and 10% each year. About 3% of that was for our normal operations, another 6% for the roads.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I guess what I'm trying to understand is on this increase from 1.6 million or billion to 3.2 billion over the past 20 years, is that is the majority of that for maintenance, or are you actually building more roads during that time? For that increase,
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, we don't really have the information right here to answer that. There is spending data that's split up capital versus operating, so I can get you information on whether that ratio has changed over time and what it is, but I don't know it off the top of my head. Okay. And again, as I said earlier, since the own source spending on roads is not just property taxes, it's stuff that comes out of the general fund. So whatever goes in the general fund, property taxes, state aids, and other miscellaneous things, is what's going to pay this own source spending. We don't know exactly whether the proportion of that that's property taxes has changed over time, but I think what you'll hear from the individual cities who do know how their budgets work is that, especially in the last few years, the state aid cuts and other changes mean that the property tax has become a more significant source of this local transportation funding than it may have been in the past.
Okay. Mr. Gagneau.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, in our case, it's about $1 million out of this total bar that would be, I would call, our regular maintenance, the pothole patching, those types of things. The thin overlay that I mentioned earlier is less than $1 million. It's a very cost-effective. In fact, we use borrowed equipment and use our own crews, so it's a very cost-effective way to do it. But we're fortunate to be able to do that. Most cities cannot. But the rest of it is for this much more expensive reconstruction. To do one neighborhood is in the $2 to $3 million range to reconstruct the roads in that area. Very expensive. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, just to, I think you had one other question, which was no, I forgot. I'll tell you later.
That's okay. It comes with age. Thank you, gentlemen, and thanks for coming again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Senator Kleiss, Mayor Kleiss. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the record, my name is Dave Kleiss, the Mayor of St. Cloud. Appreciate seeing a lot of familiar faces and a lot of new faces, but thank you for the opportunity to be here and talk a little bit about a lot of the discussion you just had is very, very similar to St. Cloud's situation. We're a little different and give the perspective of St. Cloud's perspective as a regional center. Talking about in the earlier discussion about the amount of municipal state aid that St. Cloud has had, we have a similar. Ours has been pretty flat for the last 10 years, but the needs have certainly grown over those years. And Mr. Chair, your question about the population change in 10 years, the population change in St. Cloud has been 22,000 additional residents in that 10 years. So there has been a significant increase, but again, the municipal state aid has stayed fairly flat. We have been fortunate enough, though, in the area to have a tremendous amount of growth, and with that growth has come new tax property tax base. And certainly throughout the years, the assessed value of home valuations has been fairly good. It's been double-digit up until the last 2 years. So this is where the critical point is for the city of St. Cloud and our region. One of the issues with St. Cloud in the last 5 years, if you look at total funding for road surface improvements, you're looking at upwards of $48 million during that 5 years. Of that $48 million, $35 million of that came from a city, and that in the way of levy and assessments. 32 of it levy and assessments. And $3 million, actually, thanks to the legislature in the last few years, the sales tax, the local option sales tax, has helped offset some of that, and that's something that we do on a regional basis. And one of the things I always like to highlight coming before the legislatures in St. Cloud area, the five area cities work cooperatively on a number of things, and that regional sales tax actually helps share in some of those costs for the transportation costs. In particular, fortunately it does, because as a regional center, the city of St. Cloud, some of our biggest transportation challenges are the fact that we're, as the core city, we have a number of those outlying cities that we have to maintain those roads and expand those roads because of the growth in our surrounding cities of Sartell and Waite Park and St. Joseph and Sauk Rapids and St. Augusta. As they expand in population, our property taxpayers are paying for a lot of those improvements. The sales tax has helped in that respect, but it's not keeping up, especially into the future. The other challenge we have as a regional center, St. Cloud, we have a number of federal and state facilities. For example, St. Cloud State University, the Technical College, the VA Medical Center, the hospital, and the state correctional facilities in St. Cloud, which are not paying property taxes. But again, with all of the traffic and folks coming in, the service, and again, that's the burden that's being placed on property taxes. And again, that partnership that the city and cities have had in the state with the state has been something that, again, needs to probably be increased more, and particularly, again, the situation I talk about as a regional center of St. Cloud. We have a number of challenges in that growth, and for those property taxpayers to pick up that burden, especially for folks in the outlying area or all citizens coming into the area, has increased that portion. Again, we've been able to handle it in the last several years because of the growth in inflation, and that's pretty much in the last few years we've been able to do. But now you're looking at, with home valuations, that is difficult. And for the surrounding cities, that hasn't been the case. There's been some difficult situations, especially in road improvement. Again, with $48 million dollars in the last 5 years, and $35 million of that coming from property taxes in both actual levy and assessment. That's a considerable burden that's being placed on property taxpayers when a lot of folks, and I know a number of folks from throughout the state, and we always want a lot of folks from around the state to come to St. Cloud and utilize those roads, but that's become a challenge that we've had. Mr. Chair and members, and again, that's our perspective from where we're at. Again, that partnership that has been there in the past has been, again, for the most part, that local municipal aid has stayed flat over those years, but the challenges have not. They've increased tremendously, both in population, both in the amount of road surface improvements that we've had to do, and just the growth that we've had, and the burden on the property taxpayers is something that in certainly now and in the future is only going to be more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor, and it's important to note that you know, that's the reason why we're having this meeting, is basically because local units of government are not getting the benefit of seeing any new money come their way from the state. And I think that you and the last several testifiers have highlighted that pretty well. Senator Moi.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's good to have Senator Kleist back in the Transportation Committee and here back in the Senate. I just wondered, Mayor Kleist, I mean, it's been a really difficult time listening to the local governments, and both in the Tax Committee and the Transportation Committee. So I just want to let you know that I'm working really hard with Senator Bach to try to get some LGA dollars back to the more fully developed cities, of which, you know, St. Cloud is one of the cities that we really want to do something with. And I can't remember if when you were in the Senate you ever voted for a transportation funding package, but I will hope that if you were still here you would vote for it.
Chair, Senator, well, I expected that. I have, actually, on this committee, and in the area of local government aid, as a legislator and as a mayor, my position hasn't changed. I've always been a big advocate of that, and I appreciate the support, and from what I've seen coming out of the Senate, that support for local government aid, which is critical. And, again, especially in regional centers where we both have very similar communities that have a tremendous cost as a regional center from on those issues, but that hasn't changed. But you know, as a mayor and as a former legislator, my philosophy and those things haven't changed. I've always believed that when we build these strong partnerships with the state and the local communities, we're one Minnesota, and we all do better in that. So I'm looking forward to your transportation bill when it passes and becomes law, because again, these are challenges that not only the regional centers have, or cities in our area have, but they're throughout Minnesota. So I look forward to that, and don't envy having to vote on it.
Well, that sounded like a ringing endorsement to me.
From what I see, Mr. Chair, and I didn't touch on it, and I should touch on also, there are challenges that are meeting all both local communities and the state, and I know, again, through the partnerships, but one other issue that affects our property tax folks, too, and that is transit issues. Mm-hmm. And we were fortunate Senator Dibble brought some folks to St. Cloud and had a hearing. Mm-hmm. And one thing in particular, and again with the constitutional, I know there are bills which we are very supportive of, a bill that of the 60-40 split for the 40% of transit being a 35-5 split. Mm-hmm. A greater Minnesota transit is extremely important. And if not having that type of support or split, that also translates onto property taxes. That's an issue we as a Metropolitan Transit Commission and the four or five area cities, without that type of split, it would be difficult in the future to make that up. And the only way we have to make that up is on the property tax levy. So.
And Senator Dibble and his committee have done a wonderful job of going around the state, or actually kind of around the metropolitan area up to St. Cloud, to take the testimony and find out exactly what the folks with their shoes on the concrete or broken pavement have to say. And it's been interesting, the meetings that I've made, and on the regard to the split, I do believe that at the end of the day, we're going to have a very well-funded and well-balanced bill, both for transit needs and road needs and greater Minnesota, the suburbs, and the urban cities. So we've got a placeholder on the table right now, and it's simply a placeholder. We're going to add and subtract to it, and so stay tuned. Senator Deble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it was a good hearing up in St. Cloud. It was very interesting. Had just a lot of folks show up, and they told some very compelling stories, both the system folks and the officials, as well as the folks who are directly affected by transit use. And we had a very interesting story told to us by folks who live a little bit beyond the boundaries of the transit service area, live about 2 miles out of town, kind of down a country road, who really need. I mean, these are low income folks who live in a manufactured home park, who work in the service sector of Wake Park and St. Cloud, and transit dependent, or they have to buy and own junkers or bum rides or the like. And Senator Olson and I actually drove out there to see how far is this, what does it look like, and it's pretty serious. On the 35-5-38-2, admonition and benediction to people has been let's not get anxious about that. It's a great discussion because it illustrates the need, and it illustrates a larger issue, which is there's a great deal of need that we all equally have, and so let's not get crosswise with each other about 38-2 or 35-5. My goal, reflecting Senator Murphy's comments, is that we have this discussion, this debate, which really illuminates what's needed across the state and in the metro area, and come up with the resources that are sufficient to serve what is a clear need. That's why we're having the hearings all over the metro area and greater Minnesota, we're gonna do something that'll take care of all of us. And I think it would be unwise to get ourselves crosswise with each other because we share in the need, and so to argue over a limited pot of money is probably not the best course of action.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator, Mayor. Maybe you could explain to the committee, once St. Cloud State builds their new parking ramp, how much money that might take out of the city's coffers from the college students that might otherwise go to transportation, where a new black hole will occur.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, that's another one of those partnerships, and they're building a parking ramp, and we're going to be we'll be benefiting from freeing up parking from the neighbors in the area, so we're looking forward to that. So.
The city of St. Cloud makes a large amount of money on parking tickets, and my daughter happened to, try to enrich the coffers of St. Cloud many times over while she was going to school there. Luckily, she's graduated. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Young, we appreciate that. It all helps relieves our property taxpayers.
Yes,
Mr. Chair, I did want to touch on that point and that. Just to reiterate, the impact, certainly transportation funding, state transportation funding, does have a significant impact on property tax, whether that be road funding or transit funding. And, again, my earlier comment why I didn't want to have that ringing endorsement of transportation plan, because once I endorsed a plan now, I knew there would be some controversy on the 35-5. But we know, and, again, we're looking forward to a package that, again, helps ease that burden. And that's not going to get any better. I think every city in the state, mm-hmm. especially in the last year or two with the housing market the way it is, and cities such as St. Cloud who rely on that valuation that we've had over the years based on that's actually in some areas stagnant or in reverse. So it's going to be even more challenging to provide those services. And one other thing I wanted to mention, Senator Olsen has a wonderful bill. Also, a wonderful endorsement coming up here. We have one of our lieutenants from St. Cloud here that I know the committee members who were here a few years ago are very familiar with. So that helps us out, too.
Yes. Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor. And it sounded like a ringing endorsement for a fully funded, well-balanced package.
Mr. Chair, a fully funded, well-balanced package is absolutely endorsed that.
All right.
As to what the details of that'll leave that up to the
Yeah, we'll make sure you get a look at it before we go to press, huh?
Thank you, Mr.
All
Chair.
All right. Any further questions for the mayor? And, again, Mayor Kleiss, good to see you again, so don't be a stranger.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. Let's move along. I think we have Mr. Gridley from Woodbury.
Hello. Yes, my name is Clint Gridley, and I serve as city administrator for the city of Woodbury. I'd like to give you the impact of the insufficient transportation funding for a newer East Side community. The city of Woodbury has grown from a community of 10,000 in 1980 to approximately 58,000 today, and accordingly has needed to expand our transportation system, particularly along I-494. Without available state funding to improve our connections to the interstate system, the taxpayers have recently had to pay $12.8 million for the I-494 Lake Road interchange built in 1995 and $21 million for the I-494 Tamarack interchange built in 2002. With only $1.5 million of state financial support compared to our $33.8 million. We are also looking at a frontage road along I-94 with an eastbound on-ramp in 2008. Again, the state has told us that they have no money for the on-ramp despite congestion in the area, and if we want to proceed with the on-ramp off of the frontage road, the city or the county will need to spend the extra $1 million to make that happen. And we have one more new interchange in the not-too-distant future that needs to be constructed that is not on the State Department of Transportation plan. That will cost approximately $22 million. To illustrate the financial impact, I'd like to pass out a chart similar to the one that you saw from the City of Minnetonka. And unlike their chart, this one does exclude our assessments and operating expenses. This is simply our capital and debt funding. And as you can see, the city taxpayers have been the one to step in the gap and pay the increased costs for the interchanges and the other transportation project cost. In conclusion, the City Council of the City of Woodbury strongly urges the Senate, House, and Governor to support additional financial funding for a transportation system that will have the additional benefit of providing much-needed property tax relief. Thank you for my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gridley. And we could almost, I mean, if the graph from Minnetonka was red and blue, I think they would match almost exactly. There's a little bit of a deviation in 2002, but the rest of the numbers all look like they're tracking about the same. So,
Mr. Chair,
at least you're in the same boat as Minnetonka.
Yeah. One difference is Minnetonka does include their operating expenses, and my chart just includes the capital and debt expenses. So if it had the operating expenses, it would be almost identical.
It does. I don't mean to chuckle, Mr. Gridley, but, well, I guess I do, because it's just, well, Senator Langs has been working at this a lot longer than I have, but, you know, we've been at this trying to pass a funding bill that actually becomes law long enough now that half of us feel like we're a little punchy. And, you know, it's a good thing that we have a lot of new members, some from your neck of the woods, that have brought renewed energy around this transportation issue. And with the help of a lot of folks, you included, people in this room and a lot of people that we've talked with here over the past couple months, I feel even more confident that we're going to be able to help rectify at least a small portion of your city's problems out there. I mean, we just had a ringing endorsement from the mayor of St. Cloud. I don't know if it gets any better than that. So, but from your number one tax-paying fan right here, she says thanks for being here today. So, Senator Saltzman.
I just also like to extend a warm welcome to Mr. Gridley. And also on the Tamarack Interchange, which the city paid, you know, for this interchange, we spoke earlier this year about some difficulty in transferring that interchange back to the state. Is that correct? And
that
if you
is,
might elaborate, because it seems to be a problem that really doesn't have a fiscal note on it, but it's really something that reflects how we need to support DOT in doing their job.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, that is correct. In fact, both of the interchanges I mentioned the Lake Road interchange and the Tamarack interchange, we've been unable to transfer back to the state. That was part of the agreement, that it would be constructed. It was constructed at city expense, but we've been unable to exchange it back to the state, largely because of the staffing situation at the Department of Transportation and the paperwork involved. And it's been a very frustrating process, which we have a long way still to go.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the dark underbelly of what we're talking about here. It's, you know, the department has been, because of financial constraints, have been under a lot of lot of pressure lately, and they've lost quite a few employees through attrition. People leave to take different jobs, people retire, and those folks, for the most part, are not being replaced. And it slows down the process, and you've fallen into that foot trap. And hopefully, if we're successful, the department will be reinvigorated and hopefully put on some more people, especially put on some more professional engineers, so that we can crank out projects and crank out the paperwork that you need so that you can make that swap. If we're not, it's the only thing I can say, sir, is it's going to be sparse, and it's going to continue to be sparse, and that's just the fact of the matter. So, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Senator Murphy and Mr. Gridley. It's good to see you. I, just for the committee members, I grew up in Newport and went to Woodbury High School. So what we used to do was, for fun, and I don't know why this was fun, but we would drive around Woodbury and we would look for our friends at different intersections. And that's how much the population growth of Woodbury has just been remarkable since I've grown up. But I just wanted to also mention to members that cities like Woodbury not only are facing, less money for transportation projects, even when they're facing this tremendous growth, but Woodbury also, if I'm not mistaken, lost all of its local government aid under the recent LGA formula change. So that just further compounds some of the troubles, too.
Nothing like kicking the dog when he's down.
Mr. Chair, we had the triple whammy, as I call it. We lost our local government aid, we lost the market value homestead credit, and we got property tax capped all at the same time.
Senator Jungbauer.
Oh, we're having some fun, I guess, here.
Oh.
Mr. Gridley, I do. I like the simple charts and graphs we're getting today, and I like the color better because it makes it much more visible. But I was thinking, Mr. Chair, as we go through these solutions that are going to be, glowingly endorsed by our mayors and city administrators and stuff, I think it's important that the committee have, graphs and charts somewhat similar to this, where we actually can see the impact. If we can physically have a visual for the committee as we're working through some of these to say, well, if we do a 3 cent, 5 cent, how we do the gas tax, how we do some other things, if we can overlay them and work in different city scenarios, county scenarios, I think this is the clearest way to get our message across about the actual impacts that our constituents will see in our road improvements.
And
something we can bring home to our constituents and say, we all got to bite the bullet and get this done because we're in a world of hurt.
Mm-hmm. Senator Jungbauer, that won't be a problem. We will, Ms. Boyd will make sure that when we bring the bills forward, and we'll try to do it at like varying levels of taxation in different areas, and then make the runs available to everybody so that what your counties are going to get and what your cities that are on the MSA formula are going to get, and it'll be very clear. Everyone will know. We're going to do runs like they do for K-12. Senator Watt.
Well, Mr. Chair, the other day in Senator Scoy's property tax subdivision, we were taking testimony from cities and towns and counties, and I made the comment that, I knew I was sitting in a tax committee, but it was beginning to sound like I was in a transportation committee, and today I know I'm in transportation, but I'm beginning to also feel like I'm in a tax committee, and I think that we can't, I mean, just this testimony and all the testimonies that we've heard, we just cannot underscore the importance of property tax relief in the form of a transportation package, a tax package that provides LGA relief, and really to some extent an education package that provides some property tax levy relief. I mean, that's the message that I keep getting, and, you know, I mean, it's a good thing I'm not in the education committee, because at some point I will get them all mixed up, because we will be having the same conversation. And I really appreciate the information that was brought forth. I'm thinking that at the end of the day, when we finally get these different hearings done, the message will be so resounding that we will not only have to do something about a transportation package, but we have to get a tax package out there that gives back to our cities the local government aid that they've lost.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Gridley. Next we have Mr. Sheehan from the county engineer down in Olmsted County. And then we'll have Mr. Carlson and Mr. Vanasek after that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mike Sheehan, the county engineer at Olmsted County. And what I'd like to go over with you today is we passed out a property tax used for transportation purposes, a little summary of the 87 counties. I think it's on your desk. Actually, Mr. Chair, this is a thank you to your county engineer, Mr. Greg Isaacson, has been working on this through the AMC. And I just wanted to kind of go through this to kind of show you what's going on at the county level. And the first line there is the property tax that are being put into the road and bridge revenues. The second column is the property tax that's being used for construction projects. The first project includes maintenance as well. Then you got other funds, which would include bonding, wheelage tax, gravel tax, those type of reserves and that type of thing. Also, sales tax dollars that might be generated through the county. Then the next column shows some large projects that are out there in the future. And then we got some stories and trends. So this gives you an idea. The summary of that on the third page is slightly over $150 million. Of local property tax being spent in transportation in the 87 counties. And like I say, this isn't a summary of this is a summary of all 87, but they have not all reported yet at this time. And then of that, there's about $50 million that's being spent for construction, whether it be an overlay project, a reconstruction project, or whatever. And I'd just like to speak a little further as far as Olmsted County. We've been this past year, we put close to $8.8 million into our road and bridge fund, and of that, about $3.3 million is going towards construction. And that seems to be, that's about an increase, I think you'll see with Mr. Carlson, it's about a 20% increase over 2006. And one other issue I'd like to just bring up to you at this time is we've been involved with a number of projects in the southern part of the state, working with Dakota, Goodyear, and Olmsted County, especially on Highway 52. And the bonding is a great idea, and it's been super as far as bridge bonding. The bonding for trunk highways is a good idea, except we're lacking the money that we need for the locals to for their share of the project. And in 2003, we at Olmsted had to sell bonds for $12 million to match our share or for our share of the projects that we had on Highway 52 and Highway 63. And then in 2005, we asked the voters of Rochester to extend the half-cent sales tax for transportation purposes. And they approved that by a 73% margin. So of that $32 million of the sales tax dollars, $16 million going to the city of Rochester and $16 million going to the county of Olmsted for transportation, we'll be spending approximately $2.5 million of that for our share of an interchange on Highway 52 up in the Orinoco area, which is needed for safety reasons. But I just want to emphasize the importance that we need some type of local share to match these bonding projects that are being proposed by the state or by the governor. So they're needed. But like I say, we haven't seen a, other than bonding dollars for bridges, which are really appreciated, since 88, our dollars, as far as state aid dollars, have remained the same. And I think our state aid allotment since the year 2000 has been basically flat. We have not seen an increase in our state aid dollars. So I guess my my request to you is, like some of the previous speakers have said, we're in favor of any type of transportation funding, long-term transportation funding. And as you can see here, the counties are funding a lot of their transportation projects with property tax. And when you get into the hearings in December with the county board, you've got the social services people there, you've got the corrections, you've got transportation. So there's getting to be an outcry for transportation dollars, and we need some type of long-term funding from the state of Minnesota. So with that, I'll answer any questions that anybody might have.
Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, what would you feel about an option for a county-imposed wheelage tax, say $20 wheelage tax?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we'd be in favor of a wheelage tax. I think right now the seven-county metro is allowed to do that, and in our summary there, I think three of the counties have adopted the wheelage tax, and we would be in favor of a wheelage tax.
A follow-up. I believe in Senator Murphy's bill, it's a cleaner wheelage tax where it doesn't offset a levy. So I think it'd be because right now it doesn't make sense to me. Why would you run a wheelage tax option if it's just offsetting a levy? So, so you would be more supportive then of a straight wheelage tax option for counties?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we'd definitely be in favor of the wheelage tax, especially the way Senator Murphy's bill is. You don't have to reduce your tax levy to have the wheelage tax.
Thank you, Mr. Sheehan. Any further questions? Thanks again, and you guys keep up the good work down there. I like revisiting Rochester now that I can get in and out without losing teeth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a little summary of what the motor vehicle sales tax would do for us in Olmsted County. And I also got some costs on the back of what, for example, what a tandem truck costs, what a traffic signal costs, and what a mile of overlay costs us in Olmsted County. So I don't know if I have enough for the entire committee, but I'll pass them around. And if you need more, I'll definitely get them to you.
Okay, we'll get somebody to pass them around. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. That's membership consists of 13 of the larger counties in the state of Minnesota. I just want to add to Mr. Sheehan's testimony. I've had a document passed out, and I apologize. I apparently did not bring enough to cover all the committee and the staff, but hopefully that can get rectified shortly. That shows the history of the county's property tax levies for road and bridge purchases from 2002 to 2006, the latest data that's available through the Department of Revenue. And you'll see during that time period, overall, the 87 counties, three of those counties do not report their data in a manner that allows you to break out their road and bridge levy. But for the remaining 84, their levy has gone up over 22% in that period. I believe four or five counties have gone up over 100% in that period, and that basically indicates the extraordinary burden that the road and bridge expenditures and the lack of significant funding from both the state and federal level is putting on the counties and their property taxpayers. A little additional information. The spending information that's available through the state auditor is not quite so up to date, but for a portion of this time period, 2002 to 2004, spending for road and bridge purchases went up at about 4.2% annualized clip. That compares to a 5.1% annualized clip for the levy. So that, again, indicates that basically the property taxes are substituting for what is flat or declining funding from both the state and the federal level. I assume that it's no news to this committee that the current revenue projections actually show county state aid dollars flat or even declining during this current four-year forecast horizon. So our needs are pretty dire. I'll just add one further piece of information. One other place where counties are getting resources to meet the demands in the transportation area is through debt. Between 2000 and 2004, the outstanding debt for counties increased by 73%, and a portion of that additional debt was issued for road and bridge purposes. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Carlson, in your opinion, the counties that you represent, and I'm pretty sure that at least one of them has passed resolutions supporting various types of increases to help cover some of these costs. The other counties, and I'm talking about Dakota County, I believe, passed a resolution. The other counties that you represent, have they passed resolutions, or where are they at?
Mr. Chairman, members, has members of our organization, they're all on record basically supporting anything that has been proposed for increasing transportation funding, be that a gas tax increase, a motor vehicle license fee or registration increase, local option sales taxes, wheelage taxes. We support anything. The individual counties, as you have identified, that have also enacted resolutions from time to time during the past or current year, also supporting those increases at their individual board levels.
Okay. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, some of the counties have different points of view about some of those taxes and don't necessarily support all of them, because Scott County is different than Carver County. I represent both. They've got different approaches to that. One doesn't like wheelage tax, another one doesn't like a different tax, and so it's not really right to represent to this committee that they all agree that all taxes are good, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I would agree that there's a variety of opinion, but through our organization, through our board of directors, which has two members from each of the 13 counties on it, they are supportive of the whole array of taxes that we or fees that we previously identified.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, there are counties that do not agree in the MICA organization on some of these taxes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I can't tell you with absolute certainty what each one of our individual counties' positions are. I can only tell you what our board, I do know that there's some individual members of the boards who certainly don't support the whole array of taxes or fees that we just went through, but I'm not sure of the individual, of the county board's opinions overall on the subject.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman, which one of those two counties of yours doesn't support an increase in funding?
Mr. Chair, they want more road money, that's for sure. And the way they go about it is different. I think that's true for the MICA counties altogether. I mean, it seems to me that if we pass all the tax proposals that are out there for transportation, we'll have way too many taxes and probably more money than we can spend over the next couple of years on transportation projects. So I think we better be careful before we adopt all of the taxes. And some of the counties have different positions, and I've sat in legislative breakfasts with both Carver and Scott County. I was a participating member of the Metro Intercounty Association.
Well, which one of the counties is it, Senator Ortman? Is it the one that 212 runs through? That's where I'm getting at. The county that you represent that got their money, do they support a gas tax increase?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Do they support a well-rounded, well-funded package, yes or no?
Mr. Chair, just like most Minnesotans, some do and some don't. But the county board does not have a position on gas tax, I don't believe, in Carver County, and that is the county where 212 is going through. We waited for 60 years, Mr. Chair, for funding for 212. We paid for it over and over again. We finally got the project. We've cut ground, but we have not completed it yet.
Senator
Ortman.
We
still need more funding for County Road 5, which is going to be a major highway. Mm-hmm. We have transportation issues. Believe me, we have transportation issues in Carver County. That's why I'm sitting on the Transportation Committee. But I don't think we should be misrepresenting that everybody agrees that we should raise every single tax being proposed in the Senate Transportation Committee.
Senator Ortman, I don't think anybody has said that, and I know that Mr. Carlson did not misrepresent his organization. Mr. Carlson is an employee of that organization. They voted. They said, get up there to Capitol Hill and make sure that it's a well-rounded, well-funded package. Is that not right, Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, our legislative recommendations, including the transportation
right.
funding,
and,
was...
And Senator Ortman, your community has waited 60 years. There's other communities around the state that have waited for longer than that.
There are?
Yes, there are, Senator Ortman. And Highway 14 is a classic example. Am I not right, Senator Day? The carnage that's going on Highway 14 is unprecedented in the state. And as Congressman Obestar said the other day when he was asked, why did you designate, I think it was Highway 8, and he said there's a lot of death happening there. There's been a lot of fatalities. And they said, well, why did you designate money to go to that road? And he said, because he could. And Senator Ortman, I'm going to make it real clear here. Highway 14 is going to get fixed. Highway 60 is going to get fixed. And it's because the chair said we could. Senator Olsen.
Well, one thing that I would like to point out is that in the proposal, the wheelage tax option for counties is totally something that a county board would move forward on. So that's a local decision. So if there's a concern about, you know, a county doesn't like part of the package, they certainly have that option with the wheelage tax to move forward with it or not based on the vote of elected county commissioners. So I think that's a good provision in the bill. And coming from county government, I do not believe that we could – we have so many projects backed up that, you know, the amount of money that would be raised – would be used to catch up on a backlog of projects that are primarily safety issues, really. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Vanasek? Is Mr. Vanasek here?
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Vanasek. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Townships today. We've got a population of nearly 1 million residents who live in townships around the state. I believe the number is about 1,788 townships. We're responsible for 43% of the road lane miles in the state. 59,000 miles of roads, more than any other entity in the state of Minnesota, including the state itself. Included in these miles of roadways are about 6,000 bridges, 840 of which are, as the chair knows, on the currently on the state's list of deficient bridges. Then the increased cost of maintenance and construction over the recent years has Mr. Ouellette and the city of Woodbury, the city of Minnetonka, I've got a chart from the Transportation Alliance, have indicated the amount of money being put used from the property tax resources and expended on local roads has doubled from 1988 to 2004 when you take into account cities, counties, townships. Well, in townships alone, being that we spend over 50% of our expenditures on roads and bridges, we've seen an increase, a doubling from 2000 to 2004, 105% increase in the expenditures we're spending on our local roads and bridges. The Minnesota Association of Townships supports a comprehensive transportation funding bill. We have been on record for a number of years as in support of a minimum of a 7 cent gas tax, and but we recognize that that's not the only solution. Commissioner Molnau spoke to our association last week and indicated there was a to meet all the needs in the state, the funding shortfall, the state would have to increase the gas tax 34 cents. We recognize this gas tax is not the only way to put a increased investment into transportation. So we'd support a more comprehensive bill than that. Relating to property taxes, as Senator Scoy's committee has heard, and there's a couple of folks that sit on that committee who sit on this committee, you've heard that township levies from the year 2000 to the year 2006, and again, I don't need to remind members, but townships, the residents of the townships actually go in and put in their annual meeting votes on the levy amount themselves, and they have doubled it from 2000 to 2006, the amount of money they're levying against their local property taxpayers. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Senator.
There is another cost here, because I think we talk about what is this costing communities in terms of property tax. There is another cost here, and that's the loss of jobs and business.
No.
On Tuesday morning, I had breakfast with the CEO of Anderson Windows in Bayport, Minnesota, and with no disrespect to Senator Olsen, he talked about the major investment that Anderson made in a new production plant in Mr. Olsen's district in North Branch. But when I asked him, what can we do, you know, in the state to keep you here, he said, if I knew then what I know now about the transportation difficulties that we're having in transporting our product from North Branch to Cottage Grove, we would have relocated to Menominee, Wisconsin, which means that those Minnesota jobs would be in Wisconsin. So I think that this committee has to look at, when we talk about, you know, how can we afford to do all this, how can we afford not to have a bold transportation project? So I think that's just another thing to just, I mean, we're talking property taxes today, but there's other costs as well that our communities are going to have to pay, but it's going to be a different way of paying.
Senator Jungbauer.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted a clarification as you're, you know, going to fix Highway 14 and Highway 60, since my section of Highway 65 in Anoka County last year had the number one rating for death and property damage in the state of Minnesota. I certainly hope that we're going to
fix that one too.
Fix that one too.
Yes. We're going to fix a lot of them. And Mr. Vanasek, we're going to try to do the best we can by the townships. You know, a lot of people don't pay the townships enough attention sometimes, but this is where the vast majority of your food comes from. And guess what? It just doesn't magically, mystically appear over at Rainbow. It doesn't happen. It has to go from the field onto a township road. 9 times out of 10, it's going to go on a township road. And it's going to be your milk hauler up there in Senator Scoy's district. Or it's going to be the sugar beet grower out there in Langseth's district, or it's going to be somebody, you know, pulling in the beans or the corn or whatever, and they're going to, and in my district, it starts off in the township road. It normally filters its way over to county road or the state highway, and then it comes into Red Wing, and they dump it in a barge, and poof, off it goes. Either that, or they drop it at the ADM station right there in Red Wing. You know. And those town roads, go out and drive on those town roads sometimes, especially in the wintertime. They actually have snowplow drivers out there. But unfortunately, the road surface on township roads is degrading at such an incredible rate. We're going to do the best we can. I don't think we can fix your problem, because I know that the problem is substantial, especially when it comes to fixing box culverts and some of the smaller bridges. You know, these townships just don't have enough money. And And I believe that, and I don't know if you said today, but I believe that you told me earlier at one time that 50-some percent of the property taxes that township residents pay go to fix their roads. And if 50% of the property tax isn't enough, I mean, then we have to go a different way. So thank you, Mr. Vanosik.
Thank you.
With that, is there anybody else that want to chime in on this now that we're all, at least I got my blood flowing? Okay, good. That could be good. So next on the list here is Senator Olsen, Senate File 447. And I believe that you have Lieutenant Mortensen to testify. He's been waiting patiently. He's probably heard more about road funding than he cares to. So,
I'm in favor of it.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm pleased to be in front of you today with a bill, Senate File 447, along with Lieutenant James Mortensen to testify. My interest in carrying this bill is basically it's very similar to like a stop arm violation for somebody going past a school bus. Mayor Cleese, when he was here in the Senate, basically had this bill in, and it went through, and when it was in the transportation bill, so when the governor vetoed the package, the bill kind of died at that point. So I think it has some really good merits. I do have an A1 amendment. Should I add that now or later? Okay, I would like to, as the A1 amendment is being passed out, I think I'll have Lieutenant Mortensen start speaking about the bill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Just a minute. Let's adopt the amendment. Senator Olsen, well, I guess we don't have them all handed out yet.
Okay.
People should kind of know what it is they're talking about.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment is, when the bill came out, a number of stakeholders were checking it, and there was some concern from auto dealers, trucking companies, and other businesses that, you know, their employees may be test driving a car and getting in an accident, and the car dealership, should they be charged with a petty misdemeanor when one of their employees might have done this? Or the same if the guy's cement mixer does a hit and run, is the cement company owner being charged with a petty misdemeanor? So this A1 amendment, that language should clean that up. So that's basically what the A1 amendment is for.
Okay. Senator Olsen proposes the amendment. Is there any comments on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried.
Thank you. And with that, I'll hand it over to Lieutenant Mortensen.
Okay. Good afternoon. Basically what law enforcement is looking for is another tool in their toolbox to go after offenders that are involved in hit and run crashes. The city of St. Cloud roughly has 370 hit and run crashes a year, and we're only able to charge out approximately 80 offenders a year. Some of the issues that we have is we do get license plate numbers a lot of times on these offenses, but when we go and meet with the registered owners of the vehicles, sometimes they have a case of amnesia of who they loan their car out to, or times they're just downright refuse to tell us who they loan their car to. This does kind of mirror the school bus stop arm violation statute, to where if we have one of those types of violations, we're able to charge out the owner if we're not able to get to the actual offender themselves. And it helps us dramatically in investigating these types of crimes. It's a very costly venture for us to investigate these things. And there's a lot of victims out there that don't get the offenders that commit the offenses brought to justice. Because every time a vehicle is hit, it's not only the person, the offender's vehicle that's damaged, it's also the victim's vehicle that's damaged, which, you know, takes money out of their pocket as far as having to take time off of work. They lose the ability to drive their vehicle while it's in the body shop. And we just feel that it's important that the offender that's responsible for the violation be held accountable for that.
Any questions or comments of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Have any other?
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen or Lieutenant, maybe someone can help me. I guess it operated in violation of subdivision 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7. And you mentioned stop arm violations, and the subdivisions aren't here. So I'm wondering what those were.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, the connection I see between stop arm violations is just that there was no mechanism to track down a stop arm violator before the stop arm violation law. So that's the only similarity for me, is that if somebody does get involved in a hit and run and flees, somebody gets a driver's license or the license plate number, then they can pursue it that way. And so then the vehicle owner then would be charged with a petty misdemeanor unless they kind of cough up, because a number of times they say, oh, I wasn't driving the vehicle. You know, I had borrowed it to somebody. So that's kind of where the crux of this bill is. Until somebody is, because they have a vehicle license number, but, you know, the vehicle owner says, it's my vehicle, I was not driving it at the time. And so then that's what the lieutenant said, they're kind of stuck right there. This bill would be charged with the petty misdemeanor at that time. And if they come up with a name and somebody else is charged, then there's no longer there's language that is dropped. Am I interpreting that right,
Senator Council, you wish to comment?
Mr. Chair and Senator, this bill has nothing directly to do with stop arm violations. I think Senator Olsen is just analogizing the approach to the approach that the legislature has enacted for stop arm violations, where the owner of the vehicle can be charged. And the violations in the different subdivisions that you were wondering about are all hit-and-run offenses.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chair, thank you. I was confused if 1 through 7 were possibly specific things. And then, Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, my understanding of paragraph C, lines 14 and 15, is a rental company wouldn't be Hertz National, that they're exempted there. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any more comments or questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Olsen, just for my information, what is the penalty for hit and run when they catch you?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass that one over to the lieutenant.
One more time on the question, please.
Lieutenant, what's the penalty for a hit and run? Somebody has an accident, leaves the scene and goes home, and then you catch the individual. What's the normal penalty for that?
We would write out a citation for that offense, and it's a misdemeanor violation, and they go and make their court appearance on it.
And this one is a reduced violation from that because you're not sure of who actually was driving the car. Is that the rationale there?
Correct. The kind of the rationale behind it, there's probably not one of us in this room that doesn't know who we borrow our car to. But it seems when we get involved on a hit-and-run crash and we go to talk to them about it, sometimes they're a little forgetful, or they just, like I said before, they refuse to tell us who was driving their car. Well, this in turn would make them accountable for that if they don't want to help us out with the investigation.
Mr. Chair, Lieutenant or Senator Olsen, there's a fair difference between a misdemeanor and a petty misdemeanor, and I haven't thought this through very much, but it appears to me that somebody who does that could still have amnesia and get a petty misdemeanor instead of a misdemeanor. Am I correct in understanding that?
Correct. We would not be able to take them into custody on a petty misdemeanor. On a misdemeanor, not that we would do it, but it is possible that they could be taken into custody on a misdemeanor.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. However, the alternative, of course, is that no one is charged.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Ms. Berzovsky, or maybe Senator Carlson, if a parent said that my teenager took off with my car and I told him not to do it, and, you know, I was working, we had an extra car in the garage with a set of keys, and he just took off with it, and I'm deeply sorry about what happened, does that mitigate or somehow alleviate the vehicle owner's responsibility under this legislation?
Well, it's kind of a two-pronged approach there. If they actually stole the motor vehicle, then there's a provision there. But if we ended up investigating that and they said my child took the car without my permission, well, then I know who the offender is. So then I could charge the child out for the hit-and-run crash.
And then, Mr. Chair, follow up. So then the parent then would not be charged with the petty misdemeanor?
Correct. We would just go after the child for that then.
Mr. Chair, the way I read it, though, in order to not have the car owner be charged of the petty misdemeanor, there has to be a conviction. What if the car owner gives you the name of who they say was driving, and for one reason or another, there isn't a conviction? Then are they still abdicated from responsibility because they provided you a name?
We would, if we found out who the offender was, we would not go back. And we, let's say we lost the case, we would not go back after the vehicle owner for that. I mean, our intent here is to go after the person who actually committed the offense.
Ms. Berezovsky, is that a clear in the violation in the way the statute's written?
Counsel,
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, I think it's okay for me to say that actually the senator was looking at that language and thinking that the bill should go to the Judiciary Committee because this is that little piece of it is a little bit problematic and probably could be resolved better in the Judiciary Committee.
No, I haven't had good luck there.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, I can't believe Senator Osteen is asking to come to the Judiciary Committee.
Any further comments or questions? This does need a go to Judiciary Committee. So Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 447 be approved and sent to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed no. Carried.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
No, this is.
Okay, then I'll put it over here. I don't want to mess you up over there because you got like a system going on.
I do. My bed.
She's writing you no little
just
name.
Just need to stand with quorum. I'm going to try to make it pass.
Senator Carlson?
Yes.
We didn't do it.
We have this flyer here.
Did work. So this is it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we're not.
Mr. Chair and Senators, we have Senate File 551, which is defining the concrete pump as special mobile equipment. And what this refers to is the vehicle that is on the handout that you're getting right now. These are the specialty machines that pump liquid concrete into forms. And what has happened here is that this has been a typical machine on the road that looks like a truck, acts like a truck, but it is used only off-road. And it's somehow been in this classification like a street sweeper or other kinds of machines that are used for primarily off-road work. And the Department of Public Safety has asked that it be codified that this is not an over-the-road truck. And what we're doing is we're adding it to the legislation and to the law, and we're saying that a vehicle-mounted concrete pump with or without placement boom is not a vehicle that requires an over-the-road license. And I have two folks here to help me with explaining it. First, I'll call on Mr. Fred Corrigan, the Executive Director of the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association.
Thank you, Senator, members of the committee.
Ready? I think it's almost as simple as the senator mentions in terms of just clarifying existing law that the State Patrol has been carrying out, not requiring these vehicles to have a license plate. That is the only thing that they are exempt from, with the exception of federal excise taxes. They do not pay federal excise taxes either as off-road vehicles. But every other tax that anyone would pay on a truck using the road is paid. Let me just cover quickly two issues. One is identification. These trucks are required to have a U.S. DOT number and a U.S. DOT safety inspection annually, and have that sticker on their on the truck annually, or updated annually. And they also have a vehicle identification number, a VIN number, obviously, that is carried in the vehicle as well. So from an identification point of view, the truck is well identified on the doors and with safety inspections and with ownership papers that would show who owns the vehicle. Some of these trucks, most of these trucks that are being used on the road are street legal. They're not heavy over the load road beyond legal limits, except for spring load restrictions. Some of these trucks do require permits for heavy loads, and are required to get those permits as well. From a fiscal point of view, these trucks have not paid registration fees to date. Again, the State Patrol came to us in December, along with the Department of Public Safety, we met with Commissioner Campion to see how we might resolve this. Their plan was to, short of legislative advice on how to proceed with these trucks, begin to require them to have plates in January 1st, 2008. I think I'll stop there. Again, the basic change here is to actually list the truck as one of those identified in statute, rather than asking the State Patrol to consider it to not be licensed under the but not limited to language that is in the statute today. The other thing I would add is the kinds of other trucks that are included in this in terms of quantities. There are probably less than 150 of these trucks in the state today. The other trucks that you will see that are exempt probably started with well drilling equipment. Those were probably the first trucks that were exempted many years ago. You'll also see cranes that are mobile cranes. You'll see those on the road as well. They're very similar to these, and there's probably less than 200 of those on the road. So in terms of fiscal impact, if you were to require registration, you might be talking about $30,000, not a huge impact. But today, there is no revenue coming to the state from registration. Again, they are paying sales tax. They are paying all of the other fees that any truck would pay. Mr. Chair, I'll leave it at that.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I worked on these trucks, and they're spending a lot of time on the roads. I mean, going from job site to job site, I would suspect they spend a good portion of their lives traveling, actually.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's true from site to site, but what the law on registration is set up to, and the reason for this particular statute, is to cover those trucks that are not doing the basic function of the vehicle on the road. In other words, the only function that's being accomplished by going across the road is from at one spot to another. It's not doing any of its work on a public right-of-way. It's only being transported from one spot to another. And I think that was the intent for this exemption initially.
I see.
Senator Drungbaugh.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I agree with Senator Olsen, I would never vote in favor of this. When you go down to the end of the bill and it talks about the term does not include travel trailers, et cetera, this is no different than something that's not included, a truck-mounted feed grinder. The feed grinder doesn't do its work on the road, but it puts a lot of miles on in between the jobs. And having been a contractor for 25 years, there will be more and more of these as we pour more and more foundations arguably, this truck can go to more job sites in a day and get more work done than I get done with my excavating equipment. So unless you want to start exempting the equipment we haul our excavator with, because we are sitting on job sites for multiple days, when we know when we're pouring foundations, these guys can get in and out of 5 to 10 jobs a day, depending on the size of the foundation. So they are primarily moving things on the road. It is no different from that which it talks about here as a motor vehicle designed for the transportation of persons or property. This is on a normal truck that is designed to transport property, and so it primarily puts a lot of miles on the road and doesn't spend a great deal of time on the job site like all of this other equipment that's listed here is primarily off-road equipment. The types of cranes that are exempt here, they can't even typically get up to a road speed and don't spend the majority of their time on the road like the concrete pump trucks do. So this is, in my opinion, not a good bill.
Well, it's on the bill. Originally, we're listed as...
Hey, will you identify yourself first?
My name is Dan Rentz. I'm with Apple Valley Ready Mix. The bill originally says pumping equipment up above the original bill is where it... is where it was, that's where it fell under until here 2 months ago. And the vehicle, when the vehicle goes to a job site, it's the vehicle's on the job site 2 to 2.5 hours. You're comparing it to an excavator. An excavator is hauled by a low boy. An excavator doesn't pay road tax. It's loaded onto a trailer and hauled. It has no way of getting there other than being hauled to the job site. So those two aren't per se that, but the newer cranes now, the newer mobile cranes go down the road 80 miles an hour down the highways and stuff like that, the 200-ton cranes and stuff. If you look at the ones that I run into every day.
Senator Dunbar. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I guess you actually make the argument if the newer cranes can go at highway speeds, then we ought not to exempt them anymore either. But specifically, as we're not including, if you look under the not including part of the statute 168.011, this is a truck that is designed to either haul persons, but in this case, property. So it's a standard truck with a piece of equipment mounted on it that gets used on the job site. This is a vehicle that ought to be licensed on the road, just the same way as anything else. It puts a lot of miles on the road, and, well, I guess we can just leave it at that. You cannot make, I'm very familiar with these. We are on construction sites. That's my primary business other than what I do here. A house builder for 25 years in light commercial. You will never convince me that this ought to be exempted.
Senator, Mr. Chair, I guess there. I would ask council maybe to identify moving people and goods. Goods, my understanding of goods in this case is identified as carrying household products, carrying packages, carrying those kinds of things. This vehicle does not carry anything other than the crane, and that's the way this statute is structured, Senator.
Council.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I can really clarify this language, but it says designed for the transportation of persons or property to which machinery has been attached. So I don't know that it could rightfully be restricted to goods. I would say that the term property is perhaps broader than the term goods, if I understood your comment correctly. But I can't really clarify beyond that.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I think when you look at that, it's pretty clear that the underlying chassis is what we're dealing with, is what is that designed to do? And this is a standard truck chassis. This is could be used for a multitude of different purposes other than that you mounted this on. And so if you get into the statute and just compare it to one of the things that's not included would be a truck-mounted feed grinder, would be the same argument. That feed grinder never operates when it's on the road, and yet it's still required to be licensed. It does its primary job once it gets to its site.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm finding myself agreeing more with Senator Jungbauer and Senator Olsen. When I look at the list of things, the first list of things, and then the second list of things that which this term does not include, this seems more like the second list of things than the first list of things. You know, so like a fancy dump truck, you know, only the So, you know, I'm persuaded by Senator Olsen and Senator Jungbauer's arguments.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if either Senator Carlson or counsel could provide me with a little bit more context for why certain trucks are giving exception as special mobile equipment and then other trucks have to register. And then what's the policy rationale behind the registration? Is it because of excessive usage on the road and we have them do registration to help pay a tax towards that? Or if you can give us the bigger picture.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, and I just wonder if the department could also be helpful perhaps in this.
Absolutely.
In trying to make this explain the context.
Yes.
It's my understanding that vehicles that use the roads have to be registered. And I think that as this particular subdivision has grown over the years and different types of vehicles have or construction equipment have been added to it in an effort to distinguish those that are on the road just for some auxiliary purpose and those that are actually able to use the road as other vehicles do.
And Mr. Chair, I could put a real simple kind of clarification. Most of what's in the top of this subdivision doesn't have highway tires on it. It would have off-road tires. They're designed to primarily do business off the road or at a very slow speed, such as road graders, that sort of thing. What we're talking about here is a vehicle that's designed to travel on the highways, has highway tires. So there's some very simple distinctions you can make.
Okay. Department wish to comment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wall, my name is Larry Ola. I'm the Vehicle Services Program Director with the Department of Public Safety. The reason why this particular instance it came to our attention was I think it's kind of historically been a matter of semantics with the concrete pump hoist and the pump hoist.
Can you talk a little louder, please?
I think it's a matter of semantics in that currently in the statute, under well drilling equipment, pump hoists are exempt. I think if individuals go into deputy registrars and ask, is this type of vehicle subject to registration? I think if the question is, well, this is a pump hoist or concrete pump hoist, the deputy registrar may interpret this to mean, this vehicle has been exempt. So I think historically these vehicles have not had registration on them necessarily. We're not able to take out from our database which vehicles are actually concrete pump hoists and the ones that are already registered, or the ones that are already special mobile equipment are not in any way on our database. What happened in this particular case is last spring, a individual went into a deputy registrar office and asked, does this vehicle require to be registered? And the call to our office said, well, what do we have here? And the way that we looked at the statute in the last portion is the motor vehicle is designed for transportation of persons or property to which machinery has been attached. And we looked at this as machinery being attached, thus subject or not qualified under this provision of the law, but then subject to tax as a truck, as a motor vehicle. And so what happened then in further conversations with the State Patrol, we recognize that there may be people out there that are operating these types of vehicles that are not registered, and the patrol started a notification of these types of carriers saying that we're not going to issue citations right away, but give you kind of a year to try and work out the situation. So that's how the matters come before us today.
Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd also like to make mention of the fact that there might not be a lot of these vehicles out there today, but it's probably one of the fastest growing segments of the industry as we change the way we do business, as we become more energy efficient. We're pouring more foundations for houses. We're doing more things with ICF forms, the pour-in-place insulated forms that have the high-density polystyrene on the outside. You will see, as we strive for more efficiency within the construction industry, you will see more and more of these concrete pump trucks on the road. And as we talked about having money for roads, I don't think we want to be exempting things from licensing, even if it's $30,000 today. It will grow exponentially just based on the business use of this type of a concrete pumping apparatus.
I wasn't able to pick up what you said very well. Are you in favor or against this bill?
Mr. Chair, the department is neutral on this bill.
Neutral. Yes. So the committee should be neutral, too? Now, one thing I'm not clear of, does this need to go to finance? Would you say this needs to go to the finance committee? Not that that's really your call, I guess, but I don't know.
Mr. Chai, I believe I'd defer to Ms. Baraskowski here.
Well, Mr. Chair, I initially thought that it did because I thought that this was exempting a category of vehicles, but from after I listened to Mr. Ola's testimony, it sounds like that category of vehicles is not being taxed at this point, or that there's no way to know whether they are being taxed.
That's correct.
So I'm not sure because the department, what the department's fiscal note would say if one were requested of them.
Okay, Senator Carlson, do you wish a vote on this at this time, or do you want more time?
Mr. Chair, I would like to say a couple of things. First of all, that this is a category that is kind of homeless, where it appears that by the brochure here, there are some vehicles that the pumping equipment is on that may be used for other transport purposes, other truck purposes. But this particular one here is a special design. This one is a model, of course, but it does have four-wheel drive. It does have mid-model, it looks like mid-model steering even. And as Senator Jungbauer says, that this is a growing use of concrete, but when it grows, it also might be more of these, but they might make fewer miles. They might go to a place and be used for a longer time just to continue pumping. It's kind of like a crane that's used to erect prefab homes, things like that. So it definitely is in a gray area. And I would compare it more with the item called self-propelled cranes, because those sometimes are also built on truck chassis, but then they also have specially designed chassis too. So it's kind of in a mid area. And I guess if I were to say just another thing here before we have any more questions, is I would prefer to move it for a vote.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson. And having a lot of experience with 80-ton and on-up self-propelled cranes, again, if the committee were to look at these vehicles out in the front on Aurora, those self-propelled cranes do not have a standard category highway tire like these vehicles have. And it's hard to make the argument in terms of chassis. Every time a new motorhome comes out, you know, Freightliner does a new chassis of some new design. Every time that we have increased weight loads and different things, you will see all the dump truck chassis change with multiple axles. You see cement mixers have multiple steering axles on the front. So it's a very hard argument to make in terms of a specialty chassis. I would agree with you to a point when a unit like this is designed like an 82 multiple hundreds of thousands of self-propelled crane in terms of poundage, those vehicles, I would agree to say, let's classify them based on their structure to exempt them because their primary purpose is to transport it to a job, sit at that job until such point as the job is done. So that's a great argument. It doesn't fit the specific type of pumping units we're dealing with today.
Any further comments of the committee? Is the chair ready to take
Mr.
the gavel?
Chair.
Or,
Mr. Chair.
You're doing a great job.
Mr. Chair. We have, with consultation here, we decided that we would like to lay this over.
Okay. The bill will be laid over. I believe that's the completion of the business.
Do we adopt the subcommittee report already?
No.
Do we adopt the subcommittee report already? I didn't. Oh, we're not.
No, we have a technical problem with the adoption of the subdivision report from Senator Debel, so we're going to hold off on that until our next meeting where we'll get it fixed up and it will be ready for prime time then. So with that, thank you, members, and the committee is now adjourned.
Good luck with your bill.